Welcome to Horsefly Chronicles Radio with Julia and Philip Siracusa. Sponsored by Carnation. Airing live on United Public Radio Network on 105.3 and 107.7 FM in New Orleans. This show's opening has been produced, edited, narrated by Gwen Luckett at gluckett.com.
And welcome to Horsefly Chronicles Radio with myself, Julia Siracusa, and Philip Siracusa. We are broadcasting live from the United Public Radio Network on 105.3 FM and 107.7 FM from New Orleans. We are fully sponsored by Carnation, so we want to thank them for their sponsorship. We love them. You'll have to do a few things in order to participate in chat. Go over to our YouTube page, UFO Paranormal Radio. You could go to all of the Facebook stations, UFO Paranormal Network, UFO Undercover with Joe Montaldo, News on the Flip Side, all of the Horsefly Chronicles Facebook stations, SoundCloud, Podbeam, and all of those amazing platforms where you can watch podcasts. So, guys, we have two amazing guests coming on tonight. I'm really looking forward to this show. I want to welcome back to the show paranormal investigator Karen Petroza, who has been on the show before, and Mr. Chris Allen, who is an amazing country music artist and a true superstar when it comes to his music. He's also a dedicated Bigfoot investigator and researcher and a radio host. Karen is the host of Spirit Travels Radio, a published author, co-founder of Power Science Investigations of Kentucky. She's a producer and she's just a really, really nice person. So guys, welcome them both to the show. Thanks for coming on tonight, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. So take us to the beginning. I mean, I don't even know where to start here. Chris, how did this very impressive music career start for you, number one, and how did it bring you to where you are today in Bigfoot and paranormal and all of that good stuff?
Well, it started when I was really young. My grandmother bought me a Mickey Mouse crank-it-up guitar, and I thought I was a rock star. You know, and I've been doing music ever since I was wearing diapers. Couple years ago. No, I'm kidding. I've been doing music my whole life. It was actually, I've written a couple of hit songs that I'm not allowed by law to mention what they were because they unfortunately got stolen from me by a major, the king of country. We went through a lawsuit over that and I didn't have the song copywritten. So my mom was like, well, suck it up. If you wrote that hit song, you've got other hit songs inside of you. So I moved on down to Nashville and I worked on Music Row for a while, a couple of years. And I was looking for the way that I could be different than everybody around me. Because in Nashville, there's like a zillion people down there trying to do what I was trying to do. So I set up shop down on Music Row, and I was a street performer for about 2 years. And I had some of the biggest bands stop on their tour bus right there and watch me perform, along with every record label in Nashville was watching me on a regular basis performing. And I was known for having the loudest PA system on Music Row. I was right across from Shoney's at Demumbrium. Demumbrium is actually Music Row. And I was at the Hat Closet. And they kept my equipment for me there so I wouldn't have to pack it up every day. I just put it inside, come back, and perform on the street. And I was well known for having the loudest PA system on the street, which you have a decibel law. And every time the police would come towards us, my sound engineer, which was my girlfriend at the time, later to be my wife, ex-wife now, she would turn the music down as the police were walking towards us. And as they walked away from us, it gradually got louder. And blocks away, people would call me up, "Hey, can you do this song?" And if I didn't know the song, I would go home and I would learn that song, and I'd come back the next day or so and do the song. And that's why I have such a really large vocabulary, if you call it that, book on, God, thousands of songs that I do regularly. And I may not be playing them exactly note for note the way they are, but by ear, I'd play about everything that was requested for me to play, from Elvis to Godsmack, everything in between. And I met a lady by the name of Kathy Lemon, and she was going to help sign me on with a major label, but I had to have my own album. So I went into the studio down there, and I recorded Cowboy's Dream. It was my first album, and then another album, and then another album. And it just seemed like the dream was just so impossible to reach. Well, then there's 9/11 happened. And after 9/11, I was so mad at the world. I mean, I was full of anger that this happened on our soil. And I wrote this song called "Why Have They Taken God Away?" And somebody heard me play that song in the studio when I was recording it. And they asked me if I'd play live on NBC TV. And it was going to air in front of 29 million people in 32 countries. So I gladly accepted that. Didn't know if I had the song memorized yet, but I tried my best. Didn't mess up, luckily. And I performed in front of 29 million people, my first song. It went straight up to number one on the USA charts, number three on the world charts. And it was actually a spiritual rap song. And I'm not a rap artist, but we were going to have a professional rap artist come in and do the rap line to it. And they're like, "No, we like it the way you did it." So I did that. And if you listen to the song on YouTube, it's called "Why Have They Taken God Away?" And if you hear thunder at the beginning of the song, that wasn't thunder. That was a plane hitting the trade tower. And we recorded that sound, which was like an explosion. It may have been an explosion, but regardless, that some people get it confused with thunder. And right after that, Faith Hill had the world top three on the world charts, and then I had number four and number seven. I wrote another song called "Best Friend," which you could find that on any music site that sells music, even YouTube, and it made number four on the world charts. And "Do Angels Cry" made number seven, which was written by the guy that wrote the Montgomery Gentry hit song called "Hillbilly Shoes." And then on the rock charts, on the southern rock charts, we had number one and number two, and they're still, after all these years, they're still on the charts. And it depends on what part of the world you're in. We did a battle of the band in Japan, the top 100 bands in Japan, and it made number one at 38% on the blues. And we're still climbing charts in different countries currently. So I've been really blessed with that. And we have been trying to come out for a long while now with another album. And it just seems like life, you know, we went through the pandemic. One thing after another kept putting it on hold. So that's where I was at with my music. I still perform. In fact, I'm doing the Summerfest June the 8th and the 9th in Charleston, West Virginia, amongst other shows. But that's my next big show that we've got coming up.
That's amazing. That's a lot of the adult. That's amazing. So you have music out there. You get paid for your music, right?
Yes, if you listen to 20 seconds or more of my music, I get paid royalties for it.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
How did you go from being such an amazing artist, you still are, to go into the paranormal? Did anything happen to you as a child or, you know, in your music career that kind of like pushed you that way?
Well, it started off before the paranormal was, I was one of these little kids that you see things in the middle of the night and you talk to them like, you know, you're trying to scare away the ghosts and telling them, you know, "I've got all kinds of friends" or whatever. But it ended up that we were always traveling. We lived in Texas. I was born and raised in New Braunfels, Texas. And my grandparents lived in Charleston, West Virginia area, actually Chillon, West Virginia. And so we would go up there. And there was a big commotion in my grandmother's backyard. She had this, it was like a three or four story mansion that was in Chillon. Now, that's a home of this basketball player by the name of Jerry West. Well, it ended up that we went out there in the yard to see what this commotion was, and there was this monkey. Now, we know there's no monkeys in West Virginia, but there's this monkey that was up in a tree, and it was like a blondish color with a Caucasian color skin, and it was probably about 6 foot tall, according to what the adults told us. I was just a child, and it was sitting out on a sycamore branch that was, you know, probably a good 30 feet up in the air. And it was just sitting there grooming its arm and looking at us and grooming its arm and looking at us. It wasn't even the slightest bit scared of us. We had a whole yard full of my parents, my brother, my sister, my neighbors, or their neighbors. We were all out there in the yard watching it. It was close to the edge of dark. When it got dark, we went in the house. We called people. My dad even suggested to call the newspaper, but my mom was like, well, time the Charleston Gazette got there, it would already be dark. I mean, what are they going to do, shine a flashlight on it? We didn't realize at the time what we were looking at was a juvenile Bigfoot. Years went by. I had my second encounter in Dunlap Holler, West Virginia. I was walking with, at the time, a girlfriend of mine who I married and had a child with. I seen one sitting behind a tree, and it turned around and was looking at me, and I turned to get her attention to look at it, and it was gone. Well, it probably wasn't gone. It probably sat straight up. We weren't about to walk to the tree and see if it was sitting behind the tree playing peekaboo with us. We got out of there pretty quick. And at that point, I've always been, my parents always thought I was going to be a scientist. I've always studied things. I just couldn't figure out what I was looking at. And then I started researching, and people were talking about Bigfoot and all the sightings of Bigfoot. And I'm like, that's just crazy. You know, I don't know how to explain it, because I've seen two large apes in West Virginia. And then all these people are talking about the Patterson Gimlin, all these other videos on Bigfoot. And so I went out and I started doing a lot of research. I started diving into it, and I've got actually invited on all kinds of TV shows, from Finding Bigfoot, you name it. We've been on these shows. I brought Natalie Hewitt's crew down here, Bobo and all the guys. I brought them to West Virginia, and they filmed an episode in the Appalachians on the Bigfoot. And in fact, Bobo went out, he got the camera out of the car, and he was about to film me going into the woods, because we saw a Bigfoot in the woods. And I was going after the Bigfoot to, you know, just to prove once and for all, hey, right here, you know, get your camera out. I'm going after it. We've seen it, or we thought we saw Bigfoot. What it was a male deer, a buck deer that was probably in heat, and he had my name on his shoulder. I'm lucky I didn't get attacked by that deer or whatever, but we've seen a deer, and something spooked the deer off, and it ran away from us. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that I've seen in my life. But what got me into the paranormal side was when we moved to West Virginia, we bought a 150-year-old house. And the things that we seen in that house were just crazy. I mean, I never really believed in ghosts at all until I seen them firsthand. And I've had a good experience with ghosts and things in that house that just can't be explained. I was on a show one time, and they called these things, they were called shadow people. And I've actually talked to one of them, and they told me they were here to study. My management told me, it was like, you can't go in there and say that, because they're going to lock you up thinking you're crazy. After a while, I just really don't care. I mean, you believe whatever you want to believe. I don't care. But it told me it was here to study certain people, and I was one of the people they were here to study. And I swear up and down, I think they put some kind of implants that night in my shoulders, because it just feels like I have something that night that was put in my shoulders. I couldn't throw a football or a baseball ever since then. To this day, I still can't. So,
you don't know. I know that Phil wants to jump in there. That is a very interesting story. But Karen, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in the paranormal. And for any listeners that may not know you, how did you get started? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, well, I've always had an interest in the paranormal, even as a young child. What got me into it was my daughter was telling me that she was seeing three spirits at night, and she was afraid to stay in her room. So I ended up ultimately, I ended up calling a team in. And when they came in and done the investigation, I watched how it was conducted and was just very intrigued by that. And then after that, I wanted to join the team, and I did. So I've been a part of it ever since. So, but I am the co-founder of Parascience Investigation. The co-founder, Sandra Hughes. We're longtime friends. We both have been investigating for 20 years now. So we get out. We do quite a few investigations, or have done.
Yeah, you're definitely, you're out on a lot of investigations.
We are.
A lot. I don't know how you guys do it. And, you know, Chris, what you just said, I know that Phil, you had an experience like that too, where you feel like you have something inside you from, like an implant.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what he said. And, you know, David Grush, or that guy that was part of the come forward against the Pentagon, he said that they're interdimensional beings. And a lot of people describe them as shadow people.
Yeah.
And the fact that Chris said that they were studying us, you just can't make some of the stuff up, even if you try. And, you know, just too many people that come forward with similar experiences that are highly professionals, and they put themselves out there, and it's interesting, right? Have you seen them again after that, Chris?
Well, you know, not only myself, my mother, my children, all three of my boys have seen them. My neighbors have seen them. The first time that the first encounter I had with them, it was at my house that was 150 years old, and we're sitting on the couch. Now, I had already been divorced from my third wife, and the kids came. It was my visitation with the children. They stayed at my house over the weekend, and I thought I saw something through the peripheral inside of my head run by, and it was quick, and my children started really freaking out. And they told me there's something in this house. So we went around with flashlights, looking under the beds, looking everywhere. We didn't see anything. Well, they went back home eventually. And it was, I don't know how many weeks or so after that, I was in my house by myself. And I've never been scared of really anything. It was like bright daylight. If there was a doorway, it was like it leaned like my hand, like, leaned over the behind the wall and looked at me like this from the waist up, and it bent over in an odd way. It was like a human shape, and it was so black. There was nothing to it but black. You didn't see eyeballs. You didn't see anything but black. But it was kind of like a playful how it would like lean around the doorway and look at me and stand straight back up. If it was like peeking around the doorway looking at me like that, I'd freaked out. But the way it did it so playful, it still scared the hell out of me. I left the house completely unlocked, and I left. And I finally got my courage. I was like, I'm not going to let whatever I just saw chase me out of my house. That's my house. So I went back to the house, and I looked behind everything. I didn't see anything. I laid on my bed, and it was behind the curtain. And it peeked out from behind the curtain, and it starts talking to me. Now, you didn't see a mouth move. The curtains are pretty much right against the wall, so I don't know how it got behind the curtain to do what it did. I wasn't on any medications or anything. I wasn't hallucinating. And it told me that they were sent here to study certain individuals, and I was one of the ones they were here to study. And I told it I didn't mind if it studied me as long as it didn't harm me. That night, I had this, I don't know if you call it a dream or what, but I couldn't wake up from the pain. It was hurting so bad. I felt like there were hands going through my stomach and under my rib cage up into this area, to where it felt like I just passed out in my sleep. I mean, I was, you know, when you're trying to scream and you can't scream, I don't know if that was a dream or if it was, I was in so much pain in my sleep. I don't understand that part of what happened. But when I woke up the next day, which I was really good at baseball, and I was on the football team, I was on the baseball team, and to this day, I still can't throw a football or a baseball very far or hard. it felt like in both of my shoulders right here, they put an implant in my shoulders. Now, my management, I promised them on many radio shows, I wouldn't say this because they're going to lock me up thinking I'm crazy or whatever. And after a while, you know, I just got this attitude, you know, I really don't give a damn if somebody believes it or not. I would go on TV and be, hypnotized. Take me to get an MRI or something and find out, because I want to know, is there something in my shoulders? And if anybody ever wanted to send me to a place and do that, hands up, let's go get it done. Because I could feel something in both of my shoulders ever since then. When my children came back, I asked them about this. Now, I didn't want to scare my children. I said, okay, each of you take paper and draw what you saw. Now, how you could tell what I saw was completely different. It wasn't like a black shadow of a horn. I looked at it more like if it was hair, like how a baby has hair that goes up and curls over into like a little point like this. It had this crest on top of its head that curled over a little bit to one direction. And both of my children drew exactly what I saw and was talking to me. So they saw exactly what I saw, the exact same thing, because they both drew that on top of its head. So I really don't know where. And my mom lives in Texas, and she has seen them materialize through the wall where she's at. So whatever they are, I don't have a clue. I do not have a clue what these things are. And I did have a communication, just a brief encounter, where it talked to me.
Did it talk to you through telepathy?
It was just as clear as I'm talking to you. So I don't know if its mouth was so black you couldn't see it talking, but it was exactly like I'm having a conversation with you right now.
That's amazing. I've heard these stories. So you're not alone. I've been interviewing people for years, Julia and I, years. And I cannot tell you how many people explain it very similar to you. And I had a similar experience myself. And the fact that walls and doors and windows don't even matter, they can go right through it.
And what do you think they are?
I go back to what this guy said when they were trying to do the whole, they're trying to come forward and say, hey, we're not alone. These are interdimensional beings. That's my belief. It's a higher intelligence that's studying us. He said these aren't what you think they are. These are interdimensional. Which means that we're seeing the shadows, the silhouettes of these things. And that's as far as our conscience can actually go. And a lot of people say, well, how come you can't get them on camera? There's a lot that we don't know. Maybe we don't have that type of technology yet to capture these things the way we want to, you know, the smoking gun for sake. Karen, you're a paranormal investigator. What's your thoughts on this?
Well, as far as shadow people, I've not had that type of interaction with them. I have seen them. I don't know. They're still a big mystery to me, but I'm interested in what Chris said, because I've never had one interact with me in the sense of what he had it, how it was with him. So anything is possible.
I thought I brought them back with me because I died in the hospital years ago. I took my life through suicide.
Huh.
You know, and I was in heaven. I was in heaven with Jesus, and he was explaining to me my life. And when he told me my time wasn't done, and I started falling, and I was falling hard. Like if you're going down a roller coaster, you're falling. I hit that operating table. And I hit it so hard, I could have swore I bent the table. I came straight up, and Dana Hart was there at the CMC General Hospital in Charleston, West Virginia. And the first greeting I had to Dana Hart was I puked all over him. They pumped my stomach twice with a Zorbitol. It was like a black charcoal stuff they put in my stomach. And he had my catheter wrapped around his hand, getting ready to rip it out of my body when I came back to life. And the amount of time that he told me I was dead, it was a very long period of time. And they already had me in the morgue prepping me for, you know, whatever they do down in the morgue. And I thought maybe I had brought some kind of evil entity back with me. But I didn't feel like it was evil whatsoever. It didn't appear to me to be evil. Just its actions was very odd. But, I mean, how do you know if it's good or bad? I mean, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
When you died, where'd you go?
What is it?
Where'd you go when you died?
When I died, I was like floating into the, in fact, I was going to write a book. It was called Into the Light. And when I left the operating table, I started floating upright. And I felt my spirit leaving my body. And I kept floating and floating upright. And I was ice cold, but you couldn't tell the difference of warm or cold. I passed this opaque window. It was a really large window. I'm guessing probably 12 feet by 20 feet or so. And it was almost the color of like a milk carton. I mean, you know, the plastic jug. There was silhouettes standing behind that, that it almost looked like it was human standing in there, that they may have had wings. They may not have had wings. I can't swear to that, but it almost, because you couldn't see through it. It wasn't clear, but you could see dark shadows standing behind this window, nothing around, just this window that was lit up inside the window. And I floated right past it. Next thing, I was sitting on this beautiful stone floor. Now, all of my life, I collected igneous sedimentary and metamorphic rocks. I collected every kind of fossil, rock, gem, my entire life. But I couldn't identify the cold floor that I was sitting on, but it was almost like a cool to the touch, like granite. And I looked around me, and it was almost probably about a 20 foot by 15 foot room. And I didn't see a torch in there, but if you take a tiki torch with about a foot flame, you could read a newspaper in there. It was bright enough to barely read a newspaper, a very comfortable ambient light. I heard two voices outside the corridor speaking, and it almost sounded like a doctor and the nurse talking to each other. And they were speaking in a language at the time I had never heard. And all of a sudden, this man walked in the doorway and was the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my life. It was, I knew right then and there who it was. It was Jesus Christ, which he doesn't look exactly like he does in the paintings and everything, but he looks very close to that. And his eyes definitely were not blue. His eyes were a honey gold color. He had the Mediterranean look to him. The complexion was a little bit darker than mine. But he had the most beautiful honey gold eyes, and his hair was brown, and with the light shining on one side of him, it had a red hue to it. And he sat down on the floor right in front of me. He started explaining to me about my life and started telling me about my life. And he went through about seven dogs. Now, I grew up in an area kind of like pet cemetery. All my dogs, almost every dog I've ever had, was either hit by a car or something happened where they died. And he said, you taught yourself, I'm making it shorter than the whole conversation was, but he told me at the end of when he went through each one of the dogs, he said, you taught yourself to never give anyone your heart. Once you give them your heart, you're vulnerable. And so I would always protect it. I wasn't the best husband. I wasn't the best, you know, person, because I didn't want nobody to love me.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that you have such, that alone right there is such an amazing story. I would love to see and write a book on just that. What a story.
Well, you know what's interesting? He said that during the near-death experience, he's seen the shadows. Again, it's ringing a lot of bells here, what this man is saying tonight.
Yeah,
a lot of bells to myself and people I've interviewed. So there's definitely something to it. What happened to Karen's screen?
I don't know if she can hear us. I have no idea.
Hope the shadow people didn't get her. There she is.
Well, that's fascinating.
I want to give a shout out to everybody in chat. Orsi, Jen, hello, Marianne, Rose. Thank you for joining us. They do have some questions. People with near-death experiences often have an out-of-body experience also. I don't think ETs are dangerous. The only dangerous ET experiences are those from the government. Okay. Well,
now, if the shadow person looked like Joe Biden or somebody, I think I would just jump straight to hell.
I'm not sure if I have a comment on that one, but that's interesting. Marianne, you have a figure moving around behind you. Is that Phil? If that's Phil, I'm not surprised. If that's what you mean, because he is in the basement of the Horsefly house. So that's, I don't know what she means there, but thank you everybody for joining us. You know, I do have a question. There is a question that I do have for you, Prince. When you were doing a lot of your Bigfoot, when you were out there investigating and researching, were you ever to get any DNA?
Actually, we did. We've got DNA several times. And in the beginning of the collection of DNA, I want to tell you about one of my DNA collections. I took my teenage son with me, and we found this giant scat, and it had a sphincter lying through it. Well, anyways, I took a sterile open container and a sterile utensil, and I put some in there, sealed it off. Well, I can't leave things just like that. So we're making some comedy videos where I had some stuck on the container, the spork type of thing that we scooped it up with. And I had it like over here. Now the camera was over here and I had my tongue sticking out. So it looked like I was about to eat the Bigfoot poop. Do not do this around a teenage kid. Well, like my kids anyways, he kicked my arm and it went right in my mouth. So yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But nevertheless, we've actually collected, and a lot of times in the beginning of collecting it, we sent it in to government places and it never came back. The results, they were like covering it up. And this is before they had the law that you can't shoot at them in Washington. You'll get in trouble if you shoot at a Bigfoot or whatever, which that right there tells you that the government is telling you they're real. Or why would they have a law that you can't shoot at them if they're not real? We've actually sent DNA off to a lot of different places. And some of the people that I actually went on research with, which I've been out on a lot of groups with a lot of all across the United States and in Canada. One of the guys, he actually cried to me because he was selling tickets to a Bigfoot that was frozen in a freezer, Thomas Gardy, when he was on CNN. And he was like, Chris, I had no idea that these people took my money because they wanted it, the money right now, right now. So when you get fake people, you know, trying to wear a costume or do stuff like that, it destroys the credibility of professional researchers. And he swore to me, we're in Pennsylvania. I went all over the United States with Tom Biscardi, by the way, and he is a promoter, but inside he is a true Bigfoot researcher. I give the man a lot of credit for what he is. I mean, he is a promoter and you're going to promote. But he does. He's a very serious researcher. He flew me out to Vegas one time, and then I had Alex Hearn pick me up, and they took me. They gave me my own bodyguard, and we were staying at this place for 30 days up in the White Mountains. And I'm like, so what's the plan? Oh, there's no plan. We're just going to sit here and wait for Bigfoot to come and get warmed by the heater. I'm like, tell me you're joking. But they weren't joking at all. Like, okay. Well, we found out that we're getting ready to be hit by a blizzard, and I told Rob, you're going to take me off this mountain now. And he's like, well, I can't, I'm told I have to stay here. And it's like, well, then I need your truck because I'm leaving this mountain. So he took me down, and every place from Flagstaff to Kingman, Arizona was booked because this was such a huge blizzard coming in. Annalise owned the pizza joint, and Sligman. Now, if you heard the cartoon Cars, you know, Mater and all that, that's actually Sligman, Arizona. The whole town is where they got the idea from Cars. It's decorated like that. And Annalise owns a place called the Pizza Joint. And she said, well, all of our rooms are booked up, but if you stay here and perform tonight, we will find you a room magically. It may have paint cans in there. It's like, gladly. And I got to perform out there that night, and they were singing my music to me louder than I could sing to them through their PA system. When we went to retrieve in our hotel room that evening, the wind was a consistent 77, 80 miles an hour, nonstop. And we came off of an 8,600 foot mountain where we were at, and we went down to the bottom of that mountain, and the wind was nearly 80 miles an hour forever. Found out that the people that were in the hunting lodge next to us, all three of them froze to death up there I mean, they froze to death and were found dead up there. And it's like, always listen to your intuition. If your intuition says, get off that mountain, get off that mountain. And we did.
You have to. You have to listen to that. Marianne says there's an older lady behind Chris. An older lady behind Chris. Okay. Well.
Is she harmless or is she good looking or what? I mean,
harmless. What I think, I always say that you would feel it. Like if you know, if it's something negative or something evil or not, or you would know. You know what I mean?
I think it's my grandmother actually, and she follows me around and protects me.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I think that you probably know that. Yep.
Yeah.
Karen, I know that I want to get into, you had something that happened to you in February. What did you experience and how did this affect you? I know that you wanted to talk about this.
Well, Sandra and I had originally went to go do an investigation at an old mine here in Kentucky. It's no longer in use. And we'd been out there before and had no incidents whatsoever, but this night in particular, we go out and it didn't feel right. Everything was just off. It didn't feel, we just weren't comfortable, but we could hear something inside this mine. It sounded like rocks were being moved around. You could hear shuffling inside that mine. We acknowledged that presence of whatever was inside by letting whether it was a person or what have you, know that we were there. And never got a response. So after, I don't know, I guess 10, 15 minutes of just standing there and listening, we decided to leave. And there's a cemetery about a mile away. And as we were leaving, we laughed it off. We were unnerved some with it because that was not something that normally happened whenever we went out there. And we go get in her vehicle and down to the cemetery. Now, mind you, this is out in a very heavily wooded area. Both locations are. So, and we had no cell service. That was another thing, because you go out there, you don't have cell service. So, anyway, we go down to the cemetery and we get there. And I'm driving, and as we pull in, she just makes this off the wall joke. She said, turn it around facing outward in case we have to get out in a hurry. We laughed about it. And I did that, and I pulled down, and we got out, and we decided to not go inside the cemetery because it was locked. So out of respect, we didn't go in, but we did stand outside the gate and was taking pictures. We were there maybe 5 minutes, and we're taking pictures. I heard a rustling noise and thought it was coming from the left of me. I honestly now think about it and just don't know which direction it was. But I turned and took the picture down towards the road. And in the process of that, we decided to switch positions or locations of where we were standing, because she went uphill and was taking pictures, and I went downhill and took pictures. And then we switched back out. And we were just casually talking during that time. We didn't get out anything and record because we were just going to take pictures and go to another location and do a hunt from there. And I turned upward, and there was an old outhouse on the outside of this cemetery. And I took a picture, and I turned back around. And to be truthful, I don't remember what I was going to do from that to that. I think I was going to do another picture, but I really didn't have time to think, because within just seconds of that, we hear this loud whoop noise, and it was like deafening, and it was almost like it was on top of us, and there was no sound. I mean, there was no other animals, no, you didn't hear frogs, you didn't hear anything, just nothing. And it was kind of strange. I mean, we kind of took in the fact that it was just, it didn't feel right. It was just like really, really quiet that night. No sound whatsoever. But I was frozen, terrified. I was trying to oh, I was trying to comprehend what I'd just heard. And it just didn't make sense to me what I'd heard, because I'd never heard anything about, you know, anything like that at all before. And Sandra went to turn, and I didn't even think about it. I never said anything to her. But I turned around and went to walk away. And as I was walking away, I mirrored it. I was like, nope. And then I said a couple explicit things, you know, because I was just that frightened with it. And all kinds of things. I was like, if I ran, it's going to come out at us. I could feel like it was watching. I knew it was watching. Knew that I would make it to the vehicle in time if I took off running. Just a whole lot of stuff. I mean, it was excitement. It was fear. It was just a lot of stuff in, you know, just wrapped up. And then it took me days to be able to actually comprehend and come down from that, just from the sheer fear of it alone.
Is this where you and I were going to go look at?
Yeah, you still need to come down. So go show it.
I definitely, that's on my bucket list of near things to do.
Okay.
And that was the question too that I had. How did the two of you meet?
We were both in jail at the same time. And no, kidding. We've been friends for a long time on Facebook. You probably have a lot of people that are watching the show or listening to the show that are friends of both of ours, all of ours, actually. It's kind of like a family, because when I did a lot of these events that I was at, like the St. Albans Sanitarium that we were talking about earlier, I have performed there several times, and that's just one of the many. And so you get to meet all these people, and some people go to all these events. And so you meet a lot of lifetime people with similarities, a lot of things, and seeking to find the answers. You know, I guess that's how we're all out here, because in a way we're all scientists, because we want to understand what we're researching.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that answer. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I wanted to say about the cemeteries too, Karen, that is the most, you know, it's really scary. And I think what people really need to understand is that paranormal investigators, we're still human and we still get scared. And I will never forget once being in a cemetery investigating. We were looking for a little girl that was buried in there, and she had Down syndrome. And so she couldn't really communicate. She was still communicating that way. And so she was throwing rocks at us, and, you know, to get us to go to where we needed to go. And I will never forget, I was scared, petrified, because even though I knew what was going on, we were getting hit with rocks, like literally getting hit with little baby rocks. And then what you said before, there was something screaming all the way at the end. That was in New Jersey, all the way at the end of the cemetery. And we didn't know if it was an animal. I don't think it was an animal. We don't know if it was something else. I don't know what it was, but it was, had this awful scream. It was very scary. And that too, that will never, sometimes things just don't leave your mind. Like it gets imprinted, right? Imprinted in your brain, and you can't forget it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's been like for me, you know, from time to time, because we weren't recording that night. I mean, we were going out to go do a paranormal investigation. So because that gate was locked, we opted to not record and just take pictures. Now, I wish we had been recording, because we would have had a phenomenal piece of evidence, because, like I said, it sounded like it was right on top of us.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, but then I think back and I don't remember hearing an echo, you know, usually something like that. And especially in the location we were at, it should have been, there should have been an echo, but there wasn't, you know. Yeah. It was just no, I mean, it was just the, and the only thing I can describe it as is that we looked up audio to see if we could pinpoint what we had heard. And there is the Sierra sounds, I think, or it's a 1972 Bigfoot call. And it's identical to that.
Yeah, that's the noise. A lot of them, because I've had dozens of encounters with Bigfoot, and some of them as close as 20 feet or so away from me. And they do make that noise that you described when you described it to me on the phone that time. I have a group of them that live right down the road from where I'm at. And for the longest period of time, I've always told myself, I'm going to bring, you know, my researcher friends in to this. But then after a while, you know, it's like, I'm more protective of them more so than before. I was trying to get the truth out there because people are like, oh, they can't be real. Why doesn't people have good photos of them? And when you study photography, which I've been in college for almost 7 years, and I took a couple elective classes in photography. I'm not a professional photographer at all, but light reflects off of most colors except dark. If you took a bear running through the woods and you filmed the bear in the dark with the light on your camera, you're probably not going to be sure what you saw run by the camera because it's black. It absorbs light. And that would be the same thing with a Bigfoot. Now, all Bigfoots are not black. There's a lot of them that's like an orangutan orange. Like the first one I saw was a blonde color. And there's the pod that lives not far from where I'm at. I've been there and I've researched with them many times. And it's every time I go there, it's a very scary situation. But I put myself in my friend Jane Goodall. She taught me a lot about researching Bigfoot. And so I did a lot of things. She's actually invited me a long time ago. I was in Nebraska and wanted me to come down to Northern Tennessee on a research with her. And I couldn't make it at the time. And then that's when I got a phone call. My father was in hospice. So I had there was no way I could have went to that. But regardless, I had a tea. It was a tea just like this one. And I took the lid and I twisted it off. Now the juvenile was about 15 to 20 feet in front of me behind a log. The trees that were probably a little larger than this bottle, the tops of the trees would shake when they walked down and they grabbed the tree as they're real cautiously walking towards the area that I'm at. And the juvenile sat back just watching, like over top of the log, watching me like that. I took the drink and I twisted the lid off. I took a drink and I put the lid. I'm holding it right out in front of me so it could watch what I'm doing. I took two drinks out of a full bottle and I set it down on the log. And when I left, I came back the next day. Both bottles were there, but they were both completely empty and the lid was back on it. The lid was back on the bottle. Now, a lot of people are like, well, you know, the Earth, we got so much sophisticated technology. Why haven't we? You can see things from space from the satellite. Let me explain this. They live, if you take an igloo, but made out of tree branches, dirt, leaves, and you have a little opening, just like an igloo, but made out of earth. You can fly a drone directly over the forest looking at everything below you, and you're not going to see where they live. They do stay in caves too, but this was they were living in a bunch of man-made earthen type of domes with a small doorway that they got inside. The female, I got the best look at her more than anything. Her hair on her head was kind of a reddish color. Her body was a silverish black. Like the skin was a grayish color. The hair was black. Now I have seen gorillas in zoos because that was one thing that Jane Goodall told me to do was go to the zoos and study the gorilla. So I went to several zoos, Cincinnati Zoo, San Antonio, Atlanta, Georgia. I've been to a lot of different zoos to study the gorilla. And when a gorilla beats on his chest during a crowded summer day at the zoo, you'll hear that beating, you know, throughout the entire park, if you know what you're listening for. A gorilla is large, but they're nowhere near the size of a Bigfoot. So that means more power and the beating. A lot of people think they beat on trees. I don't think they beat on trees. I think they're beating on their chest. But when you take the continental drift and we North America and South America split apart from Eurasia, China, South America, they have gorillas. We don't. Well, I think we do because as close as I have been to them, I see more of a gorilla in them than I do a human. They are very intelligent creatures. They're very intelligent. Well, I mean, think about it. They could hunt year round and they could pinpoint accuracy. My ex-wife and I, we were at Sherwood Lake where I brought Natalie Hewitt's group, Finding Bigfoot up there. We were camping in a blizzard, the tail end of a blizzard. And I don't know why I let my ex-wife talk me into camping in a blizzard, not once, but twice. That was so damn cold. But nevertheless, we heard this. It almost sounded like I heard a buffalo running through our campsite area. But before that happened, they were triangulating, beating on their chest. And what we figured what they were doing, they were trying to get the deer into a pack, and then they attacked the deer. They chased them down and threw rocks and killed and took off. Well, we found one of the bodies of a deer. I had a Canon 5, I don't remember what it was. It was some kind of Canon camera. That was my ex-wife's camera, and a camera bag on my side. This deer had fresh blood coming out of its nose, and it had a Nerf football sized rock imploded inside of its chest. There's not a human alive that could take a rock and throw it to completely collapse the chest of a deer. It killed that deer, obviously, right on the spot. Before I could open that bag, I had the fear of God, your sixth sense, if you want to call it that, tell me, get out of there now. That's a food source, and that's its food, and we're right there. We're in danger. We left. I didn't even bother taking the camera out. You know, that right there would be a shot, a photo that you definitely want to show the world. But my life to me and my ex-wife's life to me meant more than a picture of a deer. So you'll get the naysayers. Oh, if it happened, you would have got the picture. No. When you see that right in front of you, like 2 feet in front of you, and you got a little berm of dirt right there with something behind it, you're not going to sit there and take your camera out and get that shot unless you're more crazy than I am. And I'm pretty crazy. But
you know, that's actually one of my questions. What do you think they eat? I mean,
they eat everything we eat virtually. I mean, I'm not saying pizzas or whatever, but if you put a pizza in a trash can, they're going to eat it. They eat turtles, they eat fish, they love bamboo shoots like 6 foot up. When you go through a bamboo forest and look at the bamboo about 6 foot up, a lot of times you'll find the bamboo twisted where they take the more tender tops off the bamboo and they'll eat that.
Wow. Very interesting. And my last question that I do have is, like, what do you think they are? Like, where do they come from? Like, what is that theory that in your research, what did you find out with that?
They're a North American gorilla, in my opinion. There's a lot of people that's going to be objective to that. That's fine. We're all entitled to our own opinions. A lot of people think they're just a wild man. No, they're definitely not a wild man. Now, my house that's in the Philippines, they call it Capri. We live up in the mountains in the Philippines, and we were going to have a house built by this big waterfall, but the builders will not build the house there because they know about the Capri there. There's a lot of sightings of it there. It's worldwide. When I have a guy that I talk to, he had the most kills in Vietnam. Not that that's something to brag about, but he said that they were I think it was Mel Gibson or somebody made a movie about the walking ghost or something like that. I don't remember what it was, some kind of war movie. But when they're walking through these rice fields at nighttime, they were told to shoot at anything that moves. And he said sometimes these giant creatures, like, you know, bigger than orangutan, would jump up and start running, and they're machine gunning them. They'd find blood, but they never would find the creature. Now, if that was a human, they're going to be dead body parts laying everywhere. But he said many times we had these large gorilla-looking type of creatures that would just get up and take off running, and they hit them with the machine gun several times because of blood evidence on the ground. They're worldwide, and there's no shortage of them. There's a lot more of these creatures than what people think there are. They don't live. They're not solitaire where they live. Now, there are rogue. I believe, this is my opinion from all the years and years and the decades of research that I've did with this. You're like a beaver, for example. A rogue beaver will separate and it'll go for many, many, many miles till it finds what it's looking for. And I believe they probably do the same thing. These creatures, they eat about everything we have. They love meat. They have they'll pick things from trees, apples, pears, or over in that area, papayas and, you know, whatever, bananas. But they're very intelligent, and they could survive in extreme cold temperatures. So now, it was originally thought that they became extinct during the last major ice age 30,000 years ago. So that got me going around the United States, and I went to a lot of tribes And I spoke with a lot of elders in a lot of different tribes. And there wasn't one tribe of Native Americans that wasn't firm believers of the Bigfoot. Skookum, Hairy Man, depends on what area of the United States that you're at. And they have all had recent encounters with them, which is obviously did not become extinct. And then I met people that, because we found jaguar, a lot of jaguar in America. 100 years ago in America, we had a large population of jaguar in every state of the United States. And it was said to believe that they were hunted out of extinction. Now, jaguar is known to be an elusive cat. A mountain lion is on the small cat family, like your house cat, even though they're the largest of the small cat family. Then your jaguar is in the large cat family. They're capable of killing a deer or human and dragging them up a tree. And some of our researchers actually got to go on Land Between the Lakes with a body of the little girl that was up on top of the tree. Not saying that was a Bigfoot, and I'm not saying it was a jaguar. But in my years of research, I found more than one species of a Bigfoot. You've got Gigantopithecus blackie, which is in the Sherwood Lake area. I've seen a lot of the Gigantopithecus blackie. And you could find a video on YouTube of Manitoba where it shows a guy parking his car on the side of the road and trying to film, you know, maybe 1,000 feet in front of him, one walking across the road, and its head is the shape of a bison. I've actually had one when we camped in that blizzard. We're in a tent. I brought my three dogs with me, a Rottweiler, a pit bull, and a Schipperke. And we had our storage box, which is what you put in back of a pickup truck, you know, the kind of bolt to the bed of your pickup truck. We had that inside of our tent. We kept all of our gear in. And our dogs were all excited and happy to be out camping. And just, boom, just like that, the Rottweiler went over to that box, took his nose, flipped the lid open, jumped in the box. The other two dogs jumped in the box right behind him. And when I looked in the box, because that was the weirdest thing I've ever seen my dogs do, and that Rottweiler wasn't scared of anything. Well, it ended up that when I looked into that, the box, they just, you could just see the fear of these three. You always said you could throw a filet mignon in front of that dog, any of them, and they wouldn't even sniff that filet mignon. We didn't know that the Bigfoots were around us that night. And then we heard them beating on their chest at different locations of the lake. When we woke up, we tried to sleep in that tent. It was so cold. We had REI Kilimanjaro sleeping bags at a 0 degree rating, sandwiched in between other sleeping bags on a cot. I woke up having a hard time breathing because something was pressing on my chest. The wall of the tent was pushed in on my chest. And I looked over and Carrie, my ex-wife, was watching. She was like frightened to death because something had its head pushing down on my chest. I didn't know what to do. So I took the palm of my hand and smacked it just like that. And it felt like hitting a rock. It raced straight up over top the tent. Whether it was listening to my heart or whatever, but it felt like I had a buffalo head with about 40 pounds of pressure on my chest listening to me. The next day is when we went out and we took all kinds of photos and pictures and stuff of the tracks. I have the pictures on my Facebook site where you can see, I called it like an animal highway, because you can see coyote, beaver, squirrels, birds, deer, Bigfoot tracks, everything in this one area in the snow. Some of the Bigfoot.
Very, very brave. I have to say that.
What is it?
And so unfortunately, I hate the hour is up, went by so fast. And
really?
We're getting thrown off. But I would like to have a part two to this show, to be honest.
Yeah, we definitely need a part two because I have so many questions.
I've got tons of questions. Marianne, am I in New Jersey? I'm not in New Jersey. I'm not far from New Jersey, but I'm sure you have a scary cemetery. Thank you guys so much for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it. The hour went by so fast.
God, yeah, where could people find you?
Where can people find the both of you?
Karen?
Well, I'm on Facebook. You can look up, you can type in, search my name, and you'll find me there. Also, our team is Parascience Investigations of Kentucky, also on Facebook and TikTok as well, both of us, me and the team. So, social media, I'm out there.
Yep, thank you. Chris?
You can find me on chrisallen.com, and it's K-R-I-S-A-L-L-E-N, chrisallen.com, or any place where you could buy music at. You can find it as Chris Allen and Southern Thunder. I think on YouTube alone, I've got probably 50 something videos. And yes, I have to apologize. Some of the videos, I do comedy, I get bored, I dress up in a crazy costume with fake teeth, and well, you'll find them on there under Chris Allen and Southern Thunder. And then if you listen to my music, please listen to it for 20 seconds or more, and I get paid for it.
We absolutely, awesome. I have to say special thank you to Carnation for fully sponsoring the show from day one. Please join us next Monday night on the United Public Radio Network on 105.3 FM and 107.7 FM from New Orleans. Thank you guys again. Sorry it went by so fast, but we're going to have a part two to this, most definitely.
So sounds awesome.
Thank you so much, and have an amazing night.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.